Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on NABBAclub.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, Paul McKay is going to tell us his latest installment. He's a member of the 7:30 early morning study group here at NABBA. I had the pleasure of catching him tell a 20-minute version at the Atlanta Men's Workshop, the last workshop. And if he gets as much as he crammed in that 20 minutes tonight, we better buckle up your seatbelts because it's going to be quite a ride. Come on, Paul. Please come up and join us.
It's getting kind of late for a brown whiskey drinker, so we ain't fixing to go over the time. Maybe we could start this meeting with a prayer my sponsor taught me. Breathe in God, breathe out me. Breathe in God, breathe out me. Breathe in God, breathe out Paul McKay, and my name is Paul McKay, and I'm an alcoholic. There's mud in your eye. That nature's ale's all right. It really is kind of a pleasure to be up here, to be real blunt with you. If there's always a privilege to be of service or just be in an AA meeting. And it's an awful great privilege that I receive from God's good grace to be sober today. So that we can... Oh, guys, I can't dance around. I better stay still. I'm just going to start out with the fact that I did not come from a dysfunctional family. I was born and raised on a farm in Iowa. There was no yipping and screaming, drinking and yelling. We were pretty well church-going folk. Yeah, I had no fear of personal insecurity. None whatsoever. But from some of my earliest thoughts was that fear. I was always fearful. I didn't know that it was fearful that it didn't measure up. I didn't know that I didn't have much self-esteem. I didn't know that. I didn't come from a family like that. But why I got it, I have no idea. No. But it doesn't make any difference, really, does it? Hey. All I know is that as I walk through life and I was brought and raised up with parents that said, you're never going to be through with your education until you get a college degree. Hey, that's just the way it is. So there was never a thought after I got out of high school, not to go on to college. And at their times, I know I had visions of being an intellect, but trust me, my grades don't show that at all. They just don't. And I wasn't. Hey, I was your average sort of guy. When I got into AA, and I'm jumping around just a little bit. When I got into AA, there was a gentleman, it wasn't my sponsor, that said, Paul, write down those things that you used to walk through fear. Because you truly are a fearful person. I was in AA maybe about 2 weeks, give me 3 weeks, I don't know. When a guy came up to me, he had been around many years, and he said, I've been sober for 13 years, and I've never met a man more fearful than you are. May I suggest to start walking through fear that you use your full name? And that's why I use it, to start walking through fear. Okay. But anyway, that man talked, and I wrote down those things, what I saw at the time, that I used walking through fear. Okay. And I said, well, to be quite frank with you, I'm going to start with the first things I used was food. The second thing I used was sex. The third thing I used was buying things. For instance, you might think that I was a very sophisticated buyer. I was not. I was the type of person, I'll give you just one example, of I went into this store and I saw these gaudy Easter baskets. I counted them out. There were a little over 1,000 of them. You know. Now, I don't have any children, never been married. You know, but I thought, oh, that's a deal. That sign says 70% off. You know. So I made a deal and I bought them all. You know. Now, I had visions of making a lot of money on them. You know. Anyway, I had a yard sale when I got sober and I couldn't even give the damn things away. They really were gone. But that was just what I did. And then when I became 18 years of age, I found smoking. My anniversary date for smoking, I was a 5-pack-a-day smoker when I quit. That's just too much. I was a 5-pack-a-day smoker when I quit, and the use of this plan, God, and an outside help. My anniversary date for smoking is September 3rd of 1985. Now see, I didn't pick up a drink. A lot of you guys and gals picked up a drink long before I ever picked up any brown whiskey. I'm a brown whiskey drinker. Yeah. And I was 19 when that happened. But there was something about, like so many of us experienced, once I took a couple of that sips of that good old whiskey, man, I was equal to each and every one of you. My self-esteem took 100% boost. I really knew that this was Eureka. And I didn't put all this, lay all this down, but I knew good and well I now had the thing that could make me, I would be bashful no more. I still am bashful and shy, but drink whiskey in me, that makes it altogether different. I wasn't afraid to go up and ask the gals for a date, you know. But there was one thing that hit me. That was on a Wednesday, April, in Omaha, Nebraska, in 1956. And there was a dance I was going to that Saturday. I changed my friends immediately. I went from non-drinking friends overnight to drinking friends. And it was overnight. Because some of us were going to double date my non-drinking friends to go to that dance, and I didn't go with them. I found some drinking friends. That's immediately how it took to me. Right. It turned on me, as it did on most of us, I reckon. So, I would like to say that I'm very, very thankful, and I want to give grace and honor, because as the 12 and 12 says, he talks that we have, both in the third step and the sixth and the seventh step, it says, we've learned now, Bill said, maybe we have some problems other than alcohol. And I've just stated you 4 problems that I have, y'all. I wouldn't know what you'd call me, but I still keep my foot in an organization called Overeaters Anonymous. And I'm not fluffy like I used to be. One time I weighed about 285 pounds, and that's a lot of fluff to carry around. Trust me, it is. You know. I'm a member of S programs, and I thank God today, because that was the sexual area was as devastating to me as the booze ever was. And thank God that monkey's off my back today. Thank God. Because if I ever go back to drinking, I know the avenue that it's going to take. Just sure as God made little apples, it's just going to take that way. Well, my drinking went on, and I got out of college. Luckily, the dean of men tried to get me kicked out twice, but he didn't get the job done. But I didn't see that as a problem with my drinking. I kind of saw it as a badge of honor, if you want to know the truth. I really did. Oh, yeah, boy, I'm having fun. He ain't. And look at that. He's just jealous of me, or whatever my thinking was at the time. I went to work for an insurance company in Omaha, pretty famous type insurance company, and that didn't last too terribly long. I got a job, and well, let's just say I was hired in October, and they had a Christmas party, and I was drunk. But the boss's wife was there, so I thought I might do well to ask the good lady if she would like to dance, you know. And she said yes. And it was at her regret. We didn't get too far in the dance before I fell on top of her, you know. This was not pleasing to my boss or her husband. That did not stop me at all. I never gave it any thought that booze was a problem. That booze was a problem. But as the drinking progressed, and I'm not going to get into it other than to say the DUIs, the accidents, the misery, the paranoia, but that fear. If someone was to sum up to me what it was like, I could almost say 48 years of fear. I was that restless and that irritable, and that discontent was in me, but there was always, I was gripped by fear. And the only thing that relieved that fear for a number of years was drinking, food, sex, or buying. That's the only thing that relieved me. Until that last, say, 5 to 6, 7 years of all that, and that didn't relieve anything, and it just got me more fearful. Fearful and fearful. Hey. I knew I was headed for trouble. I didn't know anything about AA. Didn't know a thing about AA. I'm going to fast forward just a little bit. Remember when I told you that I was having a little trouble in college with drinking? Dean of Men wanted to kick me out twice. Yeah, took me to the board. I took a class. I must have been drinking at that point about 6 or 7 months. Give me 8. And I was taking this class, and the professor had a list, a paper list, and said, here, I don't know, there might have been about 40, 50 book reviews there, to pick up a book, review it, write a little something on it, and bring it back. And he said to the class, I don't care what you write or what book you take. So I'm walking up there and getting it, and he said, wait a minute, Paul. I want you to take this book right here. We know it as the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had totally and completely forgotten that until we were cleaning out the old farmhouse. Details aren't important. And I saw a box there, and I saw that, and I said, oh my God, I've totally forgotten it. You see, when I don't want to hear, or I don't want to break something that's giving me pleasure at the time, I don't hear it. I stuff it down. It doesn't make a bit of difference to me. You know, thank God the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has made me a little more susceptible of listening to people. I listen to my sponsors. I listen to all of you anymore. You know, I knew I was in trouble, big trouble, and I didn't know where to go. I didn't know, like I said, I had forgotten about AA. I absolutely did not know where to go. So all I could think about, because we were a family that said prayers every night in our family as I was growing up, and I thought, well, I'll go back to the church of my youth. So I started to go back to the church of my youth. And I'm saying, oh, dear God, keep me sober. Here it is Sunday, because I'm a member of the Carpenter. And I said, here it is Sunday, and just, I don't want to drink today. Honest to God, I don't want to drink today. God, you and me's got to stay sober. Right. So I'd go to the 7:30 service, and then I'd come home, and I'd get a cup of coffee, and I'd turn the TV on, and there was a very fine preacher from California, and he came on, I kind of think, like 9 o'clock, you know, and he was good, you know. Then there was another preacher from California, and he had a beautiful white crystal palace, and he was a good preacher and all this and that, you know. But I'm hanging on. I'm saying, dear God, you know, I got to hear the word now, Lord. And this word, if I hear the word, put the word on me, I'm going to get sober, I think, hopefully, through this way. You know. Now, it ain't that I ain't prayed to God before. You know. But I'm trying to formalize it a little bit. I'm trying to do more action than just kind of shaking in bed and saying, oh, God, help me, help me, help me. From a hangover or something of that nature. Well, then my boy from Oklahoma came in. That was usually around 10:30. He has a university named after him. And he was a famous preacher at that time. He's gone to glory. You know. His name was Oral. Boy, these people kind of help me. I look at it. And Oral would start preaching. I'd say, Oral, put the words on me. You know. Then my keen alcoholic mind would slip into gear. And I'd say, you know, God, if you and me would just mix us up one drink of brown whiskey, we're going to hear the word better. So I would go out there and get my 32-ounce plastic crystal, throw a little store-bought ice in there, and then fill it up with brown whiskey. Yeah. And by the time Oral got through with his preaching, I was thinking I was hearing the words pretty darn good. So I thought, I'm hearing them so good, my man from Baton Rouge is coming on pretty next. And I mean, when he preached, he had the band going, and he's walking all around there. He's rocking and rolling, and so was I. Yeah. And I'm listening to him, and he says this and that and this and that. And then in the end, he would say, now if any of you have bad health or something of this nature, alcohol or drug addiction, whatever it is, you know, let's pray. Come on up and put your hand on the TV to get saved. Sometimes I made it and sometimes I didn't. But folks, I truly do feel that all that helped me for that year or 2 years that I went through that. You know. An incident happened that, quite frankly, shook my world. There was 4 siblings. My oldest sister, she's still alive. I go up to see her. She lives in beautiful, wild Omaha, Nebraska. And then there's me. I'm the baby. Treat me tenderly. The 2 in between have gone to glory. But I had a brother who I was never close to. And the reason why I wasn't close to my brother is I got into my head that he was just a selfish, self-centered, cheap son of a gun. Why I did, I don't know, but that's what was in my head. You know. And when he died of the farm accident, and I went up to the funeral, and when we were at the plant, and that's at the gravesite, I was amazed at all these people coming out. Because it was a cold, miserable day in southwest Iowa, let me tell you. Drizzly, cold, miserable. And all kept running through my mind was, there ain't no way that these people are coming out to see a selfish, self-centered son of a gun being buried 6 foot under the ground. No. So after the padre did whatever he did, we lowered him. And I went around and asked, I don't know, I quit after I think 3 or 4 or 5. And I said, how come you came out to see my brother? And they're telling me what a kind and generous and giving man he was. And when I heard that from everyone I talked to, and it was probably 7 or 8 people were telling me that, all I wanted to do was get away from everybody, because for the first time in my life, there was something that hit me that said, "Paul, you are the selfish, self-centered son of a God. It wasn't your brother." Now, I guess you'd have to go to a psychiatrist to say, "Did I transfer something?" This, I have no idea. But I'm at peace. I'm at peace. But I realized, because of that, I missed out on a friendship, a wonderful friendship with my brother. Because we never were friends. You know, we just never were. Okay. Well, things are starting to happen. I'm a salesman for it was a large insurance company. Different one. And my territory was the Shenandoah Valley. Beautiful, beautiful country. The only thing is, problem is, that last 2 to 3 years, 18 months, I didn't get out of my territory because I was solely gripped. I'd get to work late, and when I did get to work, all I could think about was getting home. I wasn't taking care of business. It was slipping. I'm making promises. I'm lying. And the more I lied and the more the promises was, as soon as I got to work, I had to leave work because I was afraid I might get called on my lies. And I did. And that was very, very fearful. So the only thing I could think about was resorting to some of those fears and let's just go home. And all we're going to do is just have one little sippy poo, and that's going to be it. But I guess when that sippy poo is close to 15 or 20 ounces of brown whiskey, by the time you get to the bottom of it, you're kind of tipsy a little bit. Yeah. Folks, I don't know what happened, except it truly is the grace of God. I'm kicked out of all the bars. That, my incident with my brother, really shook me. And then another shaker. Didn't mean much to a lot of people, but it did to me. I had no friends. The only friend I had left was the lady next door. And she had her problems. Her husband walked out on her. But at least I had someone to talk to. I talked to her and she talked to me. She had her problems. Surely she did. But as she was getting better and walking through her problems, Paul McKee was getting worser and not walking through his problems. And so came that fatal time when I came over and I said, "Let's talk. Here's a jug of whiskey for you." And she told me she didn't want to talk to me because she was just tired of talking to a drunk like me. Man, that hurt. I really kind of forget, but then in June of 1984, after 18 months of not coming, that's the one nice thing about working for a large company back then. No one wants to deal with the drunk. They really don't. But after 18 months, they had to do something. So they came to me and said, "You have 6 months to get sober. And if you aren't sober in 6 months, don't come in because you're fired." But it was nice of them to give me that, I thought. I'm praying, I'm relieved, I'm not, I don't know what I'm doing. All I know now is the only thing that I know what to do is to drink to get out of my fear and my paranoia. That's all I know. Okay. On September 5th of 1984, don't ask me what happened. Because at least 2 years, I was always going to work late and leaving early. I got up. I'm doing pretty good. I'm saying, "Oh my mercy, I'm going to be about 10 minutes early to go to work." And by the half time I got halfway through work, and I can still feel it now as I talk about it, there was something that just said, because I'm praying to God all these years, there's something that just said, "Tell your boss you're an alcoholic and everything's going to be all right." I can still hear that in my head today. Well, that's what happened. So I'm sitting down, and we were all there, and I said, "Now, you know, boss, I'm an alcoholic." And he said, "Well, Paul, we have a procedure within this company I work for. that you do this, this, this. I wasn't really, I had an idea at that point, because I'm shaken, I'm all screwed up in the head. And he said, well, you have to go to treatment. You know, and it'd be about 30 days. And I thought, oh, that didn't sound too good to me. You know, I didn't say no, laws of me, I'm not going to do that. But I wasn't really enthusiastic, and I was. But there was Spartan St. Paul, do anything that you wanted to do. But then when he said, now let me tell you how this is going to work, Paul, this here treatment thing. He said, number one, the company's going to pay 100% of it. My ear's perking up a little bit. Number two, we're going to keep paying you the salary while you're out. Ooh. Number three, you're going to have a job when you get out, and you'll continue your salary. I had a moment of clarity, baby. I was no Christian right there. Yeah. I might be a little dumb, but Ma didn't raise no fool. At least not at that moment. Yeah. So that's just what happened on that particular item. I had a terrible time with trust. You see, I believed in God. I never have had a problem with God. I told you the type of background that I came from. But it wasn't the one thing I didn't know, and I thought I did, but it wasn't until I got into AA, as my sponsor told me. He said, well, Paul, you believe in God all right, but you don't have any trust that He works personally in your life. And until you get that, you know, you're going to have trouble. But that's where the joy is going to come. To find the God that you know works personally in your life. I immediately got involved, before I ever got a sponsor, I immediately got involved in service work. I really did. A lot of service work. I volunteered for, if they said service, I volunteered for it. I would say, good, I'll set that meeting up. Now, those were the days, too, folks, when the meetings were, you got there a good hour early because you had those pots that had to boil for about an hour. You had to set all the tables up because they always put them back, and you had, these were always folding chairs, so you had to put them all out. But what that helped me too, and there would usually be two or three people do that, I got out of my shell and got to talking to other people. You know. And I started to feel a little bit better about myself. But I'd like to tell you that I immediately got a sponsor, but I did ask. I said, "Well, I was sober, going to AA probably about 30 days." When I said I'm going to go a sponsor, and I picked that sponsor out, and because he said he was in a treatment center for 90 days and had read all the literature, and I thought, now that's the man that I need. I need someone who's got some smarts up there, yeah. So I asked him, and he got back to me 3 days. And he said, I talked to my sponsor, and he said, no, you don't sponsor Paul McKee. Yeah. Right at that point, there was a guy called Terry, and he turned over to another person in the back and said, I've been sober for 10 years, and I still don't know much. I thought, I know it kind of hit my head. I really didn't mean. I kind of thought, well, maybe I can help him out too, and he can be my sponsor. And that's just how I got my sponsor. It worked out beautifully. We sat down a day or two later, because he had obligations, and he asked me what I wanted out of AA. And I looked at that sponsor and I said, you know, sponsor, if I can just get one night that I can put my head on that pillow, and my head wasn't spinning a mile a minute, and I wasn't gripped by fear, and all I knew was paranoia, and I saw impending doom all over. Just one night. That's what I'd like to get out of AA. And he looked at me and he said, you follow these instructions, you'll have many nights like that. But he said, there's one thing, let's start off with what he considered very, very important, at least from my case. He said, Paul, there's three things you've got to have an objective and work towards. You must come to peace with your parents or whoever brought you up. He didn't say acceptance, he said peace. You must come to peace with the church of your youth. And most of all, of important, you must come to peace with your own death. And that's the most important of them all. I think I can look everyone in the eye. I'm at peace. My parents are in glory. They were wonderful. I blame my mother on an awful lot. She had nothing to do with it. I just blamed her. I'm at peace with the church of my youth. I go faithfully every Sunday. It's very important to me. Huh? And I'm at peace with death. I believe very strongly. Someone said, what's spirituality? Well, spirituality, I can sum it up in just one word. Love. That's spirituality. No. Now, I had love and lust mixed up for a long, long time. And I was grateful to a sponsor when I was telling him a little bit about my activity. He made a poem and he said, Paul, let me tell you, the only thing that love and lust has in common is the letter L. Other than that, they're diabolically opposed. Yeah. So just you remember that. Yeah. There was a lot of things else he told me. It was at that time he said, Paul, we got to change. We got to change. I said, well, how do we change? He said, well, what kind of toothpaste and shave cream do you use? And I told him with great fervor, there was only one brand of toothpaste and there was only one brand of shave cream. And anyone else was kind of a damn fool if they didn't use them. And he smiled and he said, good. But before you go home, you pick up a different brand of both and you don't use those two that you think is so good for at least 1 year. Quite frankly, I didn't use them for many, many years. You know, the shave cream, I think I bought one can after 28 years and I do use this brand of toothpaste. But that's it. Now, when we got started on the steps, he came in and he said, what's the first step? I said, I'm beat. Now, I came in on that powerless type of thing. I admitted that before I ever heard of AA or got into AA. That was not a problem. Your life's unmanageable? Well, I didn't really see it that way because my thinking was so narrow. Quite frankly, I still had my job. I never got into drugs. Some of you folks got into drugs, spent a lot of money. You know, but I never did. And I always had just a decent paying job. But when you're just drinking cheap brown whiskey, you can pay that. You know. So I said, well, we have a little problem there. And he said, well, Paul, let's look at your unmanageability in this way. When you'd pick up that drink of whiskey, did you say, well, wait a minute. Remember how you got into wrecks, you were late for work, blah, 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 blah. You tell me that you can't make friendships and so forth. That's part of life. He said, would you accept that as being unmanageable? And the way he put it, it was very simple. I said, well, sure I would. And so I moved on. He said, what about the second step? I said, I'm not insane. You see, I didn't like that idea that they're talking to me about a mental defective. What do you mean insane? No. I can hold a cup of coffee and drink it. Okay. And he said, Paul, and he picked that dang. He said, did you ever look at, well, wait a minute. This got you into trouble. You almost lost your job. You got into wrecks, etc. Your girlfriend next door didn't want nothing to do with you. Would you mind calling that insanity? I call it insanity, so I accept that. And when we came to the third step, I was just arrogant as all heck. I said, I've made that decision. I've turned my life completely over to the care of God. And he looked at me and he said, you haven't turned over, we'll use the word poop. You haven't turned over nothing. Number one, it's not making that. We're only asking you to do at this point. Are you willing to make the decision to start turning your will and your life over to the care of God? I said, amen, let's go on. He said, that's right, because we don't want to stay on the step until we drink. But I said, well, he looked at me and he said, you've made the decision? I said, yes. He said, good, get on the fourth step. Okay. Otherwise, all I've heard was conversation. Okay. So he had me started to use by the fourth step. I would carry a piece of paper and pencil, and I'd say, there's Joe Doe, what a jerk. You know, look what he said. You know, and I'd make all these little notes from AA people that I would get irritated with. And then I'd come home and put them in this brown bag. Hey? And then after it got to a point, I knew I had to do a fifth step. And I sat down with that man, with everything there, written out, except one thing, my darkest secret. I didn't think I could ever tell it. And we're all through, and he looked at me after we're through with that, and he got about 5 inches from my face, and he yelled out, did you tell me your darkest secret? And I just blurted it out. And I immediately felt completely forgiven for the first time in my life after 48, 49 years. For the first time in my life, I knew now I had a personal God that worked personally in my life. That fifth step was, quite frankly, very, very powerful for me. Others that worked differently, maybe. I'm just talking about how it worked for me. Well, now, he said, this was on a Monday. He said, now I want you to get together. And we're going to do the eighth step, because on Thursday we're going to do the ninth step. So we got together on the Thursday, and Wednesday rather, because he was busy on Tuesday. And he said, "Do you have any questions?" I said, "Well, yeah. Shouldn't we give that old 6 and 7 a kick, a lick, and a whack?" He said, "Well, glad you asked. Yeah, so I'm glad you asked." He says, I said, what do you think it is? I don't know. He said, Paul, you're terribly impatient. Terribly impatient. You know? And then he looked at me and said, what ticks you off that you get impatient about? I'm usually a little reluctant to say his, ladies, it was just me at the time. Now, I want you to understand that. It's just when I'm in a checkout counter, you know, and I've got a few little things to check out at the grocery store. And we get up there, and there's 4 or 5 women in the line, and then they check out. Oh, I got these dang coupons. At that point, a lot of charity has left me. Yeah. And I said, you know, that stuff just ticks me off terribly. And he smiled, and he said, guess what we do next Saturday, Paul, for at least 1 year? We find the longest line with women in it when we check out in the grocery store. Do I need to go on? And I started to learn patience that way. In addition to that, he was telling me, let me tell you a few other character defects you have, Paul, 6 and 7. You've got to learn to put people ahead of what you want. You see, if we were after a meeting and we were going to go out to eat, I said, we're going to go over to Joe's Cafe. And if people didn't go, I got ticked off. Or we're going to go to this movie. I didn't go to that many movies. But he said, you always are putting your wants ahead of people. He was a great person for giving me the 1 year. So for 1 year, I don't want you to pick a movie. I don't want you to pick a restaurant. And I would venture to say, after 28 years, I doubt if I picked a handful of restaurants. I picked one movie once, and it was the most god-awfulest movie I ever went to. And then I would hear such things as we went on. I did my ninth step, and he said, we're going to do a ninth step every day until we're through. Now, what was that? Well, I had a terrible resentment against my mother. So he said, fine, this is the start. I'm living in Richmond, Virginia. She lives in Omaha. So I want you to call her every Saturday afternoon, and you just ring her up and say, Mother, I love you. And if you have any other thing, or you want to say something else, you just hang up and say, well, I got to go now, Mom. I'm not lying. I needed to go. Mother did nothing. She had a beautiful mother. But because of my paranoia and fear, for some reason, I just had to blame somebody, I guess. I'm not at fault. there's my problem. Now, there were other problems, but that was the main one. You know. Then I learned that a messy house is a messy mind. That came about. I called him a sponsor about something. I forget what it was. And he said, "How's your house?" I said, "Sponsor, we're not talking about my house. I don't even..." He said, "Clean up your house. It's messy." I looked around. There were a few things out. I put some clothes on the floor, and I put them in a basket. And I saw a few dishes there, and I put that in the dishwasher. It wasn't much, you know. But he told me to call him back, so I called him back. Maybe about 15 minutes later. And I said, "Al, sponsor, what were we talking about?" He said, "It doesn't matter what we were talking about. It's not important. Just remember, a messy house is a messy mind." And so I've had to learn from those. Yeah. As I told you, I was a terrible spender. From the seventh tradition, self-supporting through our own contributions. Yeah. And all of a sudden it hit me. I'm not self-supporting. I'm piling up a lot of debt in sobriety. And guess who's supporting me? Visa, MasterCard, any credit card I can get a hold of. You see, when I hit my bottom in that in November 26th of 1986, I was using 23 credit cards. Now, you can get into trouble just with two, I'm just saying. Hey, I'm a cash-paying sort of a guy right now. That's just the way I am. I hit my bottom sexually February 28th of 1987. And that monkey's off my back. That's what God's done for me. No. I've kind of learned to cooperate. And if I'm not concerned on who gets the credit, an awful lot can be accomplished inside AA and outside AA. But when it's "I want the credit," nothing much gets accomplished. Okay. And all that does was make me think of just me, 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 me. That was my problem. All I could think of was Paul McKee. And that's why it's so important that I keep giving these steps a kick, a lick, and a whack. That's why it's so important that I make certain that I do 10, 11, and 12. No. I have to keep my house clean for me. And if I ever have a question, a doubt, I call my sponsor. And I have to get out, and I love it because I was always one of these. In the 11th step, it talks about the morbid reflection. Remember? See? Yeah. And I'd be one of these that even if I made an apology, I'd say, "Oh, it wasn't good enough. It wasn't." So I kind of keep whipping myself. Hey. And that I destroyed my usefulness to that. Just 2 days ago, there was someone that needed kind of straightening out. They did too. But it was the anger that was kind of coming out and the raising of my voice. And I apologized. And I apologized sincerely, and I let her know. Yeah. But then I'm thinking, the next day I'm thinking, "Oh, I didn't do that good enough. Oh, I didn't do that good enough." And then I thought, there you go, Paul. If a sponsoree came to you, what would you tell them? You tell them, get out of that morbid reflection. You just, you know, you made your apology, move on with life. I said, "God, why don't I take my own dang advice?" And immediately all that prompting and that guilt just left me. Yeah. There's something that I believe kind of strongly. I'll be doing God's will, and I will be a success, a very big success, if God uses me to make it, if God uses me to make everyone I meet a better person than I will ever be. Then I know I'm a success. I also know that at this late hour, I'm starting to violate, oh God, getting awful close, the second spiritual axiom. Now, some of you aren't familiar with it. Some of you do, but you're going to hear it. Now, you're concerned with the first spiritual axiom of AA. It's in the 10th step of the 12 and 12. It says that when I am disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with us, me. But there is the second spiritual axiom that's vitally important. Should never be violated, and I don't want to start. And it goes like this. The mind cannot absorb what the butt cannot endure. The meeting's over. Thank you.
Not so fast. We got a couple of announcements to make. Well, the first thing we're going to do on the 16th, we've got the children's Christmas party Sunday, 1 to 4. Noel is going to be heading up that. We've got a committee of folks, Margaret and Ira and Michelle and Richard L. One of the things that I heard today, they're going to have a basket or a barrel in the lobby where you can bring toys to donate for the kids. Now, we're also taking cash donations, and we're going to be buying some presents for kids that wouldn't normally have a great Christmas. So it's just a wonderful tradition that we do at NABA. I want you to participate. Please come Sunday, 1 to 4. January, well, let's don't get ahead of ourselves. I believe we're going to have a New Year's Eve dance. And the format and all that stuff, we haven't gotten that worked out. We'll be announcing that. January 5th, however, the Acoustical Coffee House returns. We're going to have a great lineup of musicians, and including some of those folks in the room tonight. And we're going to serve great food, and advance tickets are available tonight at $5, $7 at the door. Now, if you want to get four tickets, you can get four tickets tonight for $18. So take advantage of the discounts. Any other message? What's that? Yes, we have a 24-hour Alcathon Christmas. Do you know the hours, the details? I've been gone. Noon on Christmas Eve until noon Christmas Day.
First I slept and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. Rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. Look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promise. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Take me where the promise is.